Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation from RenegadePopCulture.com. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, and a rating on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you listen to podcasts. We are everywhere. That way, we can keep talking about what we love, and that's our extremely uneven relationship with Netflix. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your captain for this evening. Joining me, as always, is the guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And today, our main topic will be all three volumes of the Netflix anthology series, Love, Death, and Robots. We've also got some topics from Netflix's Geeked Week to discuss as well. But first, we have to start off on a downer. We lost the wonderful voice actor, Billy Kamitz, to cancer.
He died very recently. He was taking a hiatus from voice acting due to treatment for the cancer, and he was such a very good voice actor, just a lot of fun, and from what everyone has been saying online, among all the other voice actors, just one of the best people around. It's a shame that life decided to take him. And, you know, as usual, through cancer, rest in peace. My love and support and thoughts are going to Billy and his family and friends and people who are close to him. Well, we must now move on to our reactions from Netflix's essentially week-long E3 of announcing new projects, which coincidentally are announced right after they just canceled a bunch of stuff because of their incompetence in running a business.
Timing is very off.
Very sus. But as much excitement that I have for some of these projects, it doesn't quite make up for the fact that they were just canceling everything left and right and then saying, we're going to double down on stuff that doesn't cost us too much because we were spending money without finding ways to recoup it. They really need to get the people who are originally in charge of Netflix before they left instead of the ones who are in charge now. And I know some of them were from like the beginning of Netflix, but still, kick them out.
They need to reintroduce quality control.
Seriously. So, one of the bigger projects announced during the week was really an animated series that came out of nowhere, or at least this was the first time I've heard about this one, with Kid Cudi and executive producer Kenya Barris, their new show called Intergalactic, which is a painted CGI animated series about a young artist named Jabari, who's voiced by Kid Cudi, as he attempts to balance love and success. Finding the latter brings Jabari a step closer to the former, when moving into his dream apartment introduces him to his new neighbor, photographer It Girl Meadow, who's voiced by Jessica Williams. An explosion of art, music, and fashion, Intergalactic takes place in the only city that can handle all three, New York. So the cast includes, of course, Kid Cudi, Scott Mezcudi himself, Jessica Williams, Timothy Chalamet, Ty Dolla $ign, Laura Harrier, Vanessa Hudgens, Christopher Abbott, 070 Shake, Jaden Smith, Keith David, Teyana Taylor, Arturo Castro, and Macaulay Culkin.
That is a great cast.
A great cast and some names I really wasn't expecting. And it looks great. I'm so happy CGI is starting to go the stylish route. Like, we are done trying to copy Disney and Pixar. We are now at a point where technology can give us stuff that looks like this. Like, just keep it going. Don't stop.
I think we really have to thank, ironically enough, the Disney short Paper Man for kind of pushing the envelope to how far we can experiment with CGI. And this just looks incredible. We're kind of spoiled between this Arcane, Into the Spider-Verse, other more experimental projects. The fact that this came from Kid Cudi is not too surprising because he's always been a very creative individual. It's just surprising just how well this looks.
I love Kid Cudi. Some of my favorite music is from him, and it just looks great. Can't wait to watch it.
And the fact that it's set in New York is just kind of guaranteeing that I'm going to love this.
And then we got a trailer for Cyberpunk Edgerunners, based off of the Project Red game, and it's being made by Studio Trigger. It's a standalone 10-episode event series that follows a street kid trying to survive in a technology and body modification-obsessed city of the future. The story is set in the Cyberpunk universe, and even though Cyberpunk 2077 is mostly known for having one of the most disastrous game launches of all time, and really doesn't shine a good light on CD Projekt Red, a lot of this for Cyberpunk Edgerunners looks great, but that's mostly because it's Studio Trigger.
Not only that, but it's directed by Hiroyuki Imaishi, who is, of course, best known for Gurren Lagann, Panning Stocking, and Kill la Kill. And Promare.
It looks good. And who knows, maybe it will actually save the reputation for the game. And I've heard the game works now. That's great. But still, unfortunately, like right after Intergalactic footage was shown, they showed a trailer for the new show from Roger Black and Waco O'Gwin, the creators of Paradise PD and Brickleberry, their upcoming, well, next month, sci-fi comedy show, Farzar, is coming out. And, you know, we are slowly starting to head into adult animation territory where it's not just being super crass and hyper-violent. And then Farzar happens. I don't mean to come off like a snob, but Farzar, it regresses progress that adult animation has made back to that mindset of like, this is what everyone thinks adult animation is.
This probably would not be any better if it came out around the same time as the first season of Rick and Morty, but it doesn't look any better or worse. It's by the same people from Paradise PD, so my expectations are basically on the floor. But they're dressing this up to look all like sci-fi action and adventure-y, but it's also kind of your run-of-the-mill adult animated series.
We'll see, because a lot of the issues about Paradise PD is the fact that the creators kind of know that nobody likes their shows, or at the very least, it comes off like they know their shows are reviewed negatively and poke the hornet's nest anyway. So they just up the ante every single season, and they know they can get away with it because it's Netflix, and they don't have to worry about getting canceled after one season. But I mean, I want this to work. I recognize a few of the voice actors in Farzar. I'm always down for Dana Snyder getting more work.
Same.
He's probably going to be the best part about this show, but it just doesn't look good. But it looks better than Fairview. Anyway, we also got a little clip for part two of Inside Job, which shows us exactly what happened after the main character's dad got back into the lead position of the company and is taking it over. And there's also a season two happening, which was announced around the same time. And that's pretty stellar. I like that. I'm so glad for Shion Takeuchi. Inside Job was great. Like, yes, it may have had the same vibe as a lot of adult animated comedies, but it is better written than most. So, and it was also funny.
This was a genuine success in both like the writing, the animation, the general creativity of the premise. They took full advantage of exactly what they were going for, and clearly it paid off.
We also got a look at, like, during their video game day of Geeked Week, they announced a new Dragon Age anime called Dragon Age Absolution, which is being made by the same studio that made or helped out with last year's The Witcher Nightmare of the Wolf. So they're really going in on all of these Studio Mir or Studio Mir adjacent studios making video game adaptations of their work. And it looks good. I like the fantasy stuff. I have never quite enjoyed playing the Dragon Age games. I always enjoyed their writing more, or at least back then, before a lot of the dirty laundry of BioWare came out.
Yeah.
And you could just look up BioWare magic if you need any details about that.
But as for the show, it looks good. I can't really say it looks any better or worse than some of the other Netflix anime. I use that term loosely. I'm sure I will enjoy it just fine.
Yeah. I bet it will be good. I hope it's better than the Dota anime, well, quote-unquote anime that they made. I mean, I like that one, but it was also like, man, you are introducing way too much in like a short amount of time. I still need to catch up on it, but I remember liking it enough. Then they, of course, announced that the next continuation of the Castlevania franchise is Castlevania Nocturne, with just a short little teaser. And of course, they were going to make it because Castlevania was one of those adult animated shows that helped push the needle forward in terms of what adult animation could be.
Wasn't that also the show that made Powerhouse like a household name for the studio?
Pretty much. And the history is always so interesting. Like, Konami, as bad as they are, were like, we don't know if people want a Castlevania show, so let's just fund 4 episodes and see what happens. Or at least that's what the story goes. And then you watch it and it's like, well, at least the first season, and it's like, wait, that's it? The story was just about to get started. This was all just 4 episodes of buildup. And then, of course, it got better and at least it got more interesting. The third season kind of drags, but the fourth season is pretty good. We'll have to maybe talk about it at one point, maybe on a Fresh Takes or something like that.
I'm a little bit embarrassed that this is one of those shows I missed, but now that we got Nocturne coming out, I definitely want to get caught up.
We also got a full trailer for Sea Beast, which looks great. Just a fun action adventure film with some great visuals. I love the human designs. The giant and little sea monsters are all great. It just comes out next month, and I'm very much excited for it, even if it does get us one step closer to the unfortunate, you know, lineup of who knows what Netflix will be releasing next year that, you know, they haven't already canceled.
Yeah, at this point in January, we're going to do our annual preview. When it comes to Netflix, I've just gotten to the point now where I just want to let the studio surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see, because they've shown that TV shows and movies are no longer safe. And, well, we'll just have to see. But yeah, the Sea Beast looks good. We just have to really sit down and support these movies as they come out.
Absolutely.
They showed us like a bunch of quick images of shows that are in production, like Skull Island, which is being made by Powerhouse and is based off of the Kong Skull Island film from 2017. We got a new continuation for Masters of the Universe, the Kevin Smith one called Masters of the Universe Revolution. Then we got a sneak peek of a new show called Exception, which just looks stunning. Just beautiful looking visuals. And, of course, more Dragon Prince, which is one of those franchises that I couldn't quite start up.
Yeah, same.
Junji Ito is going to make some more adaptations of his iconic horror series. He's already announced that one of the episodes is going to be based on one of my favorite stories of his. And if that statue of his Junji Ito's Frankenstein is an indie indication, it sounds like they're going to adapt that story too, which If you haven't read Junji Ito's work, do so. Just do not do it at night.
Oh, yeah. The nightmares.
Oh, this stuff is horrifying. Of course, Netflix is also going to bring over uncle from another world, a at least distinct looking isekai. We'll have to see how the execution goes, because you know how it is with isekais and interesting hooks. We got a little more details about the Seven Deadly Sins film, The Grudge of Edinburgh, which will take place after the original series, which I think is going to be wrapping up soon, but we'll have to see. It comes out December 2022. We got our first look at Moonrise, which is being made by Wit Studios, which, hey, more Wit Studios, I'm down for that.
Same.
They showed a preview of, like, at the very least, the first episode of Daniel Spellbound. While its premise is nothing too out of the ordinary, it's all about a kid who deals with the magic that's basically happening right under our nose. It was fun. It was a very good first impression. And then, you know, more Cuphead is coming out. They announced some good stuff. It's just weird getting excited when your mind is kind of stuck on their recent actions. And that doesn't help that, like, on top of Geeks Week, they announced their slate of shows and films that are getting made from Europe, which includes a new Spa Studios film called Ember, which is by Sergio Pablos, the director of Klaus. And then another take on Scrooge, you know, the Christmas Carol. Another film called That Christmas, being made by Locksmith Animation. And a new Steve Box animated film. He was the director behind Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. And there's no real details, but the concept art that they showed looks sweet. And then a TV series for Bad Dinosaurs. And Mermaid Magic, which is being directed by Igneo Straffi, who directed The Winx Club. If you know The Winx Club, then you're a very mid-2000s kid.
Yep.
The Seven Bears, and then Wereworld. Like I said, a lot of stuff. I liked a lot of the announcements. I think Intergalactic is my favorite, but we'll have to see how all of these unfold.
I'm sure, like, once we actually see these, like, we'll have more reasons to actually get excited, but our relationship with Netflix remains complicated.
Let's talk about something different. More Netflix. No. But we are talking about Love, Death, and Robots, the highly acclaimed anthology series by who, Mike?
Tim Miller and David Fincher. This has been a passion project of theirs in development for, you know, decades now. This kind of began in the late 2000s, where Fincher and Miller wanted to remake the cult classic from the 80s, Heavy Metal. But then, I guess a couple years later, Robert Rodriguez purchased the rights. So they're like, we got to do something else now. And then it became what we know it today.
Well, it's like they were having problems finding funding for these films, because even for back then, when Heavy Metal came out, adult animation was kind of dying out. Like, it had its big spur within the 70s. When Heavy Metal hit in the 1980s, nobody really cared about the adult animation, and it didn't really help that people were just kind of disinterested with the anthology shorts by that point in time, which is a shame, because there are a lot of great films that are short stories connected to one another, like Memories or Robot Carnival or Short Piece. I know all of those are by Katsuhiro Otomo, but still, be quiet. Yeah, I get it, though, because adult animation was very popular on TV, but at the same time, it wasn't really there for film. And even with stuff like Sausage Party, the controversy for that film pretty much killed any chance until, you know, Sony Pictures Animation puts out their apparent adult animated films. At the very least, with Love, Death, and Robots, it's all very experimental. I am glad that they are getting different directors, sometimes reoccurring directors,
yep,
to adapt or make these different little stories.
A lot of these directors are, like, they're not necessarily household names, but that's good, because this is, like, the perfect platform for them to showcase what they can do anywhere between 6 to 21 minutes.
It also gives some well-known names some time to flex, like Robert Valley, who is just one of my favorite artists. Unfortunately, I think overall, just like as a whole, and we'll talk about like the individual seasons on their own this episode, it's a mixed bag, especially with season one or volume one, because volume one had 18 shorts. And to say that a lot of them kind of fizzled out in terms of execution is putting it lightly. Man, did it, a lot of season one come off like some angsty teenager's notebook of like, this is what adult stuff is.
I kind of have to agree. Generally, just from a conceptual level, I've always loved the idea of Love, Death, and Robots. But volume one, its biggest problem is, one, it's kind of bloated compared to volumes two and three. And kind of like what you said, most of these stories kind of boil down to like the same three essential ingredients: violence, cursing, and sex.
It comes off like those anime fans who grew up during the late 80s, early 90s OVA boom, where everything was just wildly misogynistic, hyper-violent, edgy as all get out. And they think like, man, that was the prime time of creativity. And it's like, no, it wasn't. Sometimes it was, but you were very lucky to get something that was actually good, because otherwise you just wrote everything off as just kind of dumb, cheesy schlock. And it was even rarer to find that dumb, cheesy schlock that was actually fun to watch. For me, yeah, season one, not the best foot forward. Probably could have done what volume two and three did by the number of shorts in half, because a lot of these sometimes feel like they didn't quite have enough time to really flesh out their concepts. Like the most well-known one from season one is probably The Witness by Alberto Mialgo, who also went on to work on Into the Spider-Verse. And we'll talk about him again since he pops up in volume three. And it's a cool idea, and it's very S&M, grindhouse, like sexploitation-ish kind of visuals and experience. And then it introduces that one idea at the end, and it's like, huh, kind of feels like they got caught up in all the sex and didn't really expand on the idea.
I didn't exactly love the ending of that one, but you can't say this is unmemorable in terms of the style, the editing, the sound design. It's visually, it's a feast for the eyes, but story-wise, not necessarily the cleanest.
And another thing that the show as a whole has sadly gotten into is pretty much going with the hyper-realistic route for CGI for a lot of these. And there's nothing wrong with that. We're at a point where it can actually look really good. But they don't tend to stand out as well, at least in volume one, because the more stylized ones tend to be the better ones. And which is interesting, because the shorts to me from volume one that are the best ones are the ones that had a very easy to execute concept. Like essentially when the yogurt took over.
I love that one.
Well, first of all, shout out to Maurice Lamar for being the narrator. It's only 6 minutes, and that's all you needed about a story of hyper-intelligent yogurts. And of course, there are some really cool 2D animation, like in Sucker of Souls. And that one's a lot of fun. It's kind of cool vampire stuff. But definitely like some of these, like Sonny's Edge, The Witness, Beyond the Aquila Rift, and to like rely more on like the shock of the sex and the violence, which is a shame. Because for me, like my favorites were like Three Robots, which is of course a story about three robots going through a post-apocalyptic Earth and trying to figure out and study what humans did. And it's probably one of the funniest shorts I've seen. I mean, it helps that they have Josh Brenner, Gary Anthony Williams, and Chris Parnell in the voice cast.
Oh yeah, this is definitely one of my favorites, particularly because the writing is just, it's so sharp. The dialogue is like kind of ridiculous. Like the commentary on what they think humans were like is both way off the mark but also kind of accurate at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. And I love everything with the cat.
The cat is like the best.
And I love how they're panicking and just like, just keep petting it and it won't explode. And then there is something just as simple as Suits, which is about a bunch of farmers who pilot mech suits that take down a bunch of insectoids, which comes off like either an indie video game or something from the 80s or 90s that I think kids would have loved, with the big robots and the bright colors and such.
You know what it kind of reminds me of Megas XLR.
Yeah, it kind of has some of that spirit. And it also has a great voice cast with Neil Kaplan, J.K. Bowes, Scott White, Courtney Taylor, and Tootie Roche. And the animation is just great. It uses kind of like what we're going through right now, with on top of the stylized look and different frame rate. Like, I think it's like the 12 frames a second.
Yep.
It's easy to execute. You get a really satisfying story within 17 minutes. And it's also funny at points. I love when the main guy is like, well, good news, honey. I'm moving the herd like you said. It's just one cow. Because that's what's left. And it's also really touching. I felt really bad for Jake.
Same.
And it's just like, wow, this is what happens when you take out all the stupid, edgy nonsense. Love, Death, and Robots has that something I like to call the "we are a streaming show" syndrome, where they have to grab the male audience members and they have to constantly remind the viewers that they are not watching this on TV. Because then that's when stuff like this unloads, like all the sex and the hyperviolence and the cursing, like you said. It happened with Game of Thrones. It basically was a part of Baller's identity. And I mean, like, do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, those kind of predate HBO Max. I hear what you're saying, though.
Those are still premium channels. You still had to pay a subscription fee to watch them.
Right.
Basically, it's like we are a non-broadcast standard show. That's really what shows like Game of Thrones, what Orange is the New Black, what Love, Death, and Robots kind of unfortunately fell into, until the creators were able to be like, okay, we don't need all the sex and the violence. Let's actually focus on the writing, which is why you should be here.
Exactly.
Which is a shame, because like shorts like Beyond Aquila Rift is really good and really scary, but it has that long, drawn-out sex scene, and it's so over the top. And after a point, you're just kind of sitting there waiting for them to, like, get on with it. Like, what's the twist? What's going on here?
I was definitely thinking that once we actually got to the sex scene, I'm like, wait a minute, when is the other shoe going to drop?
Yeah, and then it does drop, and it's great. It's a great twist. It's just not perfect. Really, honestly, I think the one short that does a good job with combining not only Love, Death, and Robots, but also like the violence and the sex, and they handle it well, is Good Hunting by Oliver Thomas.
Oh, I think Good Hunting is genuinely my favorite of the first season. I think I've come up with a top five that looks something like Good Hunting, Shapeshifters, Lucky 13, Zima Blue. Zima Blue is so, so good.
We'll talk about that one in a moment. But what is your last one?
And the last one, I think probably, okay, number six would be When the Yogurt Took Over. My number five would be Fish Night.
Oh, Fish Night's great. Good Hunting, which is about, it takes place during 20th century China, and is about this young man and his relationship with this shape-shifting fox, Huli Jing, and just from going from like the old days to the new days, and just how the times have changed. It balances it out better than most of these shorts from this volume and even any other ones. Yeah. To be fair, they do tone down everything in volumes 2 and 3, and that's because they have people like Jennifer Yu Nelson behind the helms of the show. Then there are just some that are just kind of cute, like The Dump. It's just kind of straightforward. An old man lives in a garbage pit and has this huge monster entity made of garbage and it acts like his dog. Like, it's cute. There's just not too much to it, and that's fine. It's kind of crass, but the charm of it all helps. And Shapeshifters is probably the best one of the more hyper-realistic shorts about how in this timeline there are like werewolves that are enrolled in the military to help the soldiers and such. Had the best story, had the best looks. It's probably also the easiest one to turn into a live-action film.
Oh, yeah.
I hope they don't. I guess that's always like the conflict of doing hyper-realistic CGI animation. Why didn't you just make it live action if you're just going to make it super realistic? Like, it's a good tech demo, but that's kind of it.
Yeah, that's why, generally speaking, when it comes to CG animation, I prefer the more stylized stuff. I'm not going to say any of these hyper-realistic shorts look bad.
No.
Because they clearly put a lot of time and energy into them. It's just not my preferred style.
Some of the more hyper-realistic ones are kind of forgettable. Like Helping Hand is a good little short, but I just don't remember it. Even though I did like it, it's just, it just didn't grab me. Now it's like Fish Night by Damien Ninal and Platige Image, the studio, about two salesmen that get stuck in the desert. That one's probably the most abstract, outside of Zima Blue. But it's definitely like one where you have to listen to the dialogue and kind of take away what they're talking about with one another. Because otherwise it's just two salesmen get stuck in the desert and then a bunch of ghost fish appear. And it's great looking.
Oh, yeah. This has some of the most gorgeous imagery out of a lot of this first volume.
Right, right. But of course, if everyone had to choose their favorite, it would be the Robert Valley directed Zima Blue, which is about a journalist going to interview a artist named Zima Blue, who's voiced by Kevin Michael Richardson, one of my favorite voice actors.
Same.
And his journey of being an artist, and as we find out in the short, a cybernetically enhanced human, and what his final philosophical art piece will be. And the journey from beginning to end is perfect. This is probably the best short of them all.
This is the one short that, like, I would recommend to anyone. And looking at Robert Valley's filmography is honestly pretty impressive.
He does a lot of good work. I highly recommend going out and searching for either shorts he's made. He's working on a movie right now, so.
That's actually pretty cool. And if you're a fan of any of the Rock Band games, he worked on the Beatles Rock Band.
Yeah, you can absolutely tell it's him in that game.
And of course, he's worked for Disney with Tron Uprising and Motor City.
Oh, I loved Motor City. I am so sad that show got no chance. Yeah, if I had to pick a top five, it would be Suits, Three Robots, Zima Blue, Fish Night, and Good Hunting. I almost put Lucky 13 there, but the hyper-realism kind of was just on me, even though I did love Samira Wiley as the lead actor.
She was great in the lead role.
I almost put Blind Spot there, except it kind of ruined its own premise a little by just being a slightly edgier version of an 80s cartoon. Even though I did love it, I love the visuals and the designs. But it just kind of comes off like this is what a lot of people think Adult Swim animation is like. And then there's just like Ice Age, not the Blue Sky films. It was mostly live action. I don't get that.
The weird thing is, it's the only one that's live action. I see what they were going for. Kind of a weird take on like something like Indians in the Cupboard.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, it's been ages since I've seen that. But it's a cute idea. I just don't think it meshes well with the rest of the shorts.
It just doesn't go far enough. It's just, oh, cool. Humans find tiny civilization inside their freezer, and that's it. Not that I have anything against Mary Elizabeth Winstead or Topher Grace or the two minor voice roles for John DiMaggio and Roger Craig Smith. It's just, eh.
Undercooked would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
And coming from Tim Miller, I certainly expected more.
And Alternate Histories was funny. Maybe a little repetitive at 7 minutes. But I did like all the different deaths and like the results of said death. Definitely a very interesting one. I'm a little shocked that the second and third volumes did not have a different take on Alternate Histories.
Same.
Like, it's one of those that feels like you could go all the way and all over the place with these. But then, like, The Secret War. It was fine. Another problem that these shorts have is that a lot of them are very much a group of soldiers defend themselves against either a horde or some unkillable beast.
That's part of the problem with, like, the repetition of some of these ideas.
Like, The Secret War is very impressive on a tech scale, but it also looked like a multiplayer mode for what was going to be like maybe a third person shooter or a first person shooter. Like, you could easily see that be the case, and that's what doesn't really work about it. And I think that's what happens when you have to have 18 shorts. They don't really have time to really make all of them stand out.
It's like when a band puts out a double album, but like only half or at most two-thirds of the track list are actually good songs, while the rest are just kind of filler.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy for it. Luckily, with Volume 2, we only had 8 shorts. And while they're still definitely hit and miss, they're definitely better than a lot of the ones from Volume 1. Of course, my favorite is still probably the other Robert Valley short.
Ice.
Yeah. And how it's a really distinct take on the theme of love. How just the whole, the colony planet, the genetically modified humans, and the relationship between a modified younger brother and his older brother, who was apparently adopted and does not have modifications on him. It was just a really sweet story.
Yeah, I like how they never really specify what modifications are. I just kind of imagine they're essentially mutants or like artificial mutants. But still, the point of this is exploring the bond between brothers who aren't necessarily blood related, but they clearly care about each other and are embarking on this crazy journey.
Right. And automated customer service is cute, just about an old woman having to deal with a killer vacuum robot and something even scarier, and an extremely unhelpful customer service hotline.
This is like every adult's worst nightmare.
Pretty much. And I know a lot of people had an issue with the art style, and I perfectly get it that some may not find it appealing. I'd rather it go like to a stylized point that doesn't work or it doesn't fully work for everyone than just playing it safe with the hyper realism.
Same. I didn't mind the art style at all. In fact, the kind of like funky proportions and just kind of off kilter like designs made this stand out a lot more than probably half of what we saw in Volume 1.
It also had some very subtle jokes. I love when the robot's reaching for the door and it just to pick up a sock and then put it in the hamper and then goes away, even though the robot's on a killing spree. And how the customer service hotline says, like, well, since you tried to shut it off, it's now going to kill all humans mode. And it's just like, it's cute. I understand why it's not everyone's favorite. And then we have probably the one that everyone loves, Pop Squad, which is directed by Jennifer Yu Nelson, which is about a future where humans traded having kids for biological immortality. And it's got some great stylized looking humans. It's a very interesting sci-fi world, and the characters are complex. Again, for 18 minutes, you get a lot out of this one short.
Mm-hmm. This gave me very much Blade Runner vibes, another sort of like neo-noir that I really got into.
It constantly made you think about like the mindset of the main characters and what kind of world it would be where humans, unless you shot them, didn't die. And just the whole issue with kids and such in a world that is obviously very overpopulated. It took me until the end to be like, oh, that's why it's called a pop squad. It's not like pop with like pop culture or music. Pop is like short for population. It was just good, which is something you can't say about Snow in the Desert, which introduces so many concepts, and yet it's 18 minutes long, and it just feels like not a whole lot is explained.
I don't remember too much about this one, other than the reason why he's called Snow is because he's an albino? Question mark?
He's an albino who has regenerative abilities that makes him immortal, and then he's constantly being hunted by bounty hunters, and then encounters this young woman. And of course, since this is Netflix and it's not on broadcast standards, they have sex, though, to be fair, it's mostly off screen. And it's not as graphic or sleazy, or it's more just like, hey, it happens, even though the characters barely know each other. And then you find out that she's a cyborg. I kind of got the overall message of it's like these two souls who are deemed different, finding compassion and companionship with one another. It's just everything around it is not as good. And it's like the whole post-apocalyptic setting, basically window dressing.
Yeah, this is one of those that just kind of belongs in volume one.
Though one of my favorites was The Tall Grass.
I love this one.
Yeah, by Simon Otto, who worked on like the How to Train Your Dragon films. And another cool stylized lower frame rate stop motion look with this creepy horror twist of like you stay on the train and you do not get off near the tall grass. Like, do not go towards the lights because what lies inside. It's basically what if you combined cosmic horror with that one sequence from the Lost World Jurassic Park with the raptors. So that's essentially how you have to look at it for that.
What's funny is I thought for a split second that this was like an adaptation of the Stephen King novel In the Tall Grass, which probably has like a similar but different premise. I'm sure Stephen King was like an influence.
Right.
But that sort of horror vibe is exactly why I like this one. Plus, it's just another stylized with like the slow frame rate.
Yeah.
That just starting to love that style.
Yeah. And it's like everything looks painted and it's a really rock solid short. And the animation done by Axis Studios in Scotland, they did a good job. Though I think my surprise favorite is All Through the House. It's 7 minutes, it's the shortest one among the eight. And it's basically what if Santa Claus was a horrific otherworldly monster, and that's it. But it has this cool mix of stop motion and CGI by Blink Industries, sorry. And I love just a whole, like, it's not long, it's not that complex, but there's some very dark, funny humor when the monster's just like trying to sense if the two kids are good, and then he just vomits up gifts, and then you find out that the gifts are exactly what they wanted. And then it's left to the imagination of like what would have happened if they were both naughty.
That's actually a great place to end that short. It strikes a very fine balance between cute and innocent, but also like terrifying. I could see Del Toro adapting this into a feature film and pretty much making like a Christmas version of Pan's Labyrinth.
Where the pale man's the Santa Claus like creature.
You can tell in that design it's clearly an influence.
Oh, obviously, with the hands coming out and such. And I love how it just goes back up the chimney and then the fire comes back and everything's okay, even though the kids are essentially scarred because they were thinking they were going to see a big jolly old man like the ones they see in their TV specials that they are obviously paying a homage to Rankin Bass.
Yep.
And Fred Tatasciore does the voice for the monster. And he just got that creepy voice. And it's very cute. It was probably like one I'm going to show my family during Christmas and not tell them a thing about it.
That's got to be fun.
And then Life Hutch is a interesting short because it combines both live action and CGI. Though I constantly had to kind of go back and forth between, is this just super hyper realistic CGI or is it like live action with CGI in a mix?
I wasn't sure about that. I know like probably like the first minute or so was very much live action, because if it's not, then that's probably like some of the best rendering of Michael B. Jordan's likeness. This is another great example of how far we can take CGI to make it this realistic. Sometimes it gets a bit into that uncanny valley area, but not always. And I think I was just more impressed by like the technicality of it than I was necessarily into the story, despite how much I love Michael B. Jordan.
It's very interesting to see how many big celebrities actually show up in these shorts. Like, I was kind of caught off guard. It's like, a lot of these have voice actors attached to them. So seeing any of the celebrities that show up, not distracting, just interesting, because I'm not really expecting to see any. And then they do show up. So
they're very few and far between, and that's good. I would rather like the lion's share of these shorts be mostly professional voice actors, but I'll never say no to talent.
And then the last one, which is probably Tim Miller's best short, just like, to me, it's the best that he's ever done. Like, I like this more than his other work, like with Deadpool and such, like The Drowned Giant, which is about, like, basically if Gulliver's Travels, but if Gulliver drowned in the ocean and just washed up on the beach, just how the humans reacted to the whole thing. Like, at first it's like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. And then it's treated like a sideshow event. And then it's just like, eh, we take it for granted that a giant human just washed up on the shore. All these giant bones, and apparently they were eating the giant human. If any of the implications were to say,
I was gonna say like cannibalism ?
Yeah.
I agree. Out of the ones that Tim Miller has directed, this is like easily his best. I kind of like the framing device too, having like the main, I guess he's a professor or something, like kind of narrate throughout, and he's kind of describing both his own experience with the giant and then the people in the town. It was just a fascinating short.
Yeah, and a lot of like what was good about volume two is they toned down on mostly everything. Like, it was still violent, there was still some sex. The Drowned Giant probably has the best penis joke I've heard in a while, and it was just better than volume one. It's like they got their edgelordness out of their system and were able to tell actual stories,
and there was more variety. Too many of volume one's stories kind of had like, they all had like a similar rhythm. You had like your ragtag team of soldiers or just like mercenaries or any sort of like five-man army or whatever. This one was a little bit more diverse.
Right. And that really helps it. Before we get to volume three, what were your five favorites? For me, it was Ice, Pop Squad, The Tall Grass, All Through the House, and The Drowned Giant.
I think that's exactly my five.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what helps with these shorter volumes is that you can pinpoint your favorites among them instead of having to be like on the back of your feet to defend some of them, like volume one. And then with volume three, we have our first sequel short with The Three Robots Exit Strategies, which is directed by Patrick Osborne, who directed the 2014 short Feast for Disney.
Oh,
yeah. It's a different director than the first time with Victor Maldonado and Alfred Torres. It's essentially going through post-apocalyptic trip, and they are finding out all the ways that humans were trying to either survive the end of the world or to get off it. And there's definitely some baggage with this, not just because of the subject matter and how they poke fun at Elon Musk and with going to Mars and such. And it's all very funny. like, I still find it very creative, even if they're a little more blunt with the commentary of just like, oh, of course, a bunch of the 1% try to make these abandoned oil rigs these paradises. But since they had no one to work on these things that were, you know, part of the 99%, they left it to an AI. And the AI basically said, screw you all. That part where the AI responds back to them saying, like, have a good day, meatbag. And then just flips the three robots off. And of course, a punchline at the end of just like, wow, so they just moved to Mars. And you see the suit and someone holding a martini. And it's the cat from the first short. Fritz Parnell reprising his role. It was great. Too bad they had to ruin it by shoving a QR code for an NFT at the end of it.
Yeah, that's like the one downer. But other than that, this short is kind of great. Yeah, the commentary is more on the nose, but at least like the vocal performances are still like sharp as ever.
Josh Brenner, Gary Anthony Williams, Katie Lowes, and Chris Parnell and reprise their roles this short. And it's probably the one you could actually turn into a TV series, like maybe like a short mini series or something with the robots going from place to place and just making fun of the humans and such. And they give them all like distinct designs and their personalities. Like, even if one of the robots is just like this big pyramid looking one, so well animated, just perfect, like, personality given to it.
She's basically a sassy know-it-all.
Yeah. Just, I love when in the first short she's like whacking the ball and she's like, bad ball, think about what you've done. It's probably the one you could actually show people and be like, hey, this is what the anthology series is trying to do. And then with the second one, which is one of my favorites, Bad Traveling, which combines Lovecraftian horror and 12 Angry Men on a pirate ship.
And this is the only short, at least as far as I know, that David Fincher actually directed, which is probably why it looks as good as it does.
Yeah, it uses a more stylized look for humans and such. It's basically about a giant monstrous crab that gets onto this shark hunting ship, eats half of the crew, then finds refuge inside the ship. And then the captain and the rest of the crew are essentially going through the moral quandary of like what to do with the crab. And it's great. It's paced well. It's probably my favorite David Fincher project that I've seen from him. And I love the atmosphere. The crab thing is completely horrifying, even though I do love crabs. And then just like the human mindset of just how some of them were saying like, no, just take them to the populated island, while the captain's like, no. It offered a very philosophical quandary of just like, what would you do in this situation? It's like a trolley problem in a way.
Yes, exactly.
That's definitely like why it's probably the best one of the bunch. Now, the very pulse of the machine is interesting. First off, it's by Polygon Pictures, the studio in Japan that's known for the Pacific Rim animated series and many anime. And yet, I didn't realize it was them.
Same. Probably their most Western production. It doesn't really have a signature style. Something about it feels like Polygon was just a studio for hire, which is like fine because it still looks great.
It's just not using that like limited movements thing that they're usually known for with their animation. It's very fluid, and the comic book art style is very cool looking with all the bright colors and such, and the trippy visuals are great.
Oh, yeah. The voice cast is awesome. And Holly Jade, and David's phenomenal performances.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the one I'll need to watch again to see if I fully get. I didn't quite gel with this one, but I did enjoy its like ambition and atmosphere. Like, it's got atmosphere for days.
But the funniest short, but like the one that had me just laughing silly, Night of the Mini Dead.
Oh, this one's great.
I did not see this one coming at all.
I've heard little things here and there that everyone was saying this was their favorite of the bunch. I mean, first of all, great isometric like look to everything, very small, and then the humor.
Something about like fast-paced action and dialogue. I don't know why, but it just like it's like one of the easiest ways to make me laugh. And this was just that for 7 minutes.
Yeah, it was very funny. And it's just like all these zombie tropes like crunched into 1 7-minute short. And how then it's just like at the end of the day, this was just one bad incident on one planet in one galaxy. Especially when they zoom out all the way to the galaxy. And then the little Earth explodes. And it's like, did this short just end on a fart joke?
I'll allow it.
Yeah. It just looked great too. Just felt like you would think everything being so small would like detract from the humor or any animation, but they made it work and it just looks great. Especially like when the power station blows up and causes the zombies to grow giant.
Oh, yep.
And then the president gets a call and it's just like, what? Oh, screw this. And just like launch all the nukes. And then I think my biggest surprise, like not in just like it was my favorite or something, was Jennifer Yu Nelson coming back to direct Kill Team Kill, which is about a group of Green Berets that end up having to fight this cybernetically enhanced bear that was made by the government to make a new super weapon that, you know, of course, went on a brutal killing spree and is now on the loose. And I was surprised to see that Jennifer was attached to this one. I was thinking it was like Tim Miller or something due to like the dialogue and the slightly edgy humor and such.
I could kind of tell this was written by Philip Gillott because I think he wrote like 99% of the shorts from volume one. It had like the similar sort of edgy humor.
Yeah. But
in terms of like the art style, I had no idea outside of like looking at the credits that this was from the same director as Pop Squad.
And, you know, Jennifer Yu Nelson also directed Kung Fu Panda 2 and 3. And Titmouse did a really good job. I had to check to see if this wasn't the Sucker of Souls studio.
It does have like a similar vibe. Maybe it is just because they have the same writer. So a lot of the same like jokes and kind of the language of these characters feels similar. The fact that these were two different studios is very surprising.
And I think even more shocking, I actually didn't mind the hyper violence and the cursing in this one. It felt like very tongue in cheek, kind of like, oh, these are super macho soldiers. And yet they get torn apart by a giant robotic bear. And of course, having a pretty good team of voice actors helps with Joel McHale, Seth Green, Gabriel Luna, Steve Blum, and Andrew Cascino helps. And it was actually kind of funny. Like it found this good balance of like dark humor and then just kind of juvenile humor.
Mm-hmm.
Like when Seth Green characters dies, he's like, please, sir, tell my wife. Please just tell her that I slept with her sister dead. It's like, oh, God dang it. These guys suck. I mean, it's not my favorite one, but I did enjoy it. Like, and that's more than I can say for like a lot of the ones from volume one.
Same.
And then I think we have my least favorite one with Swarm. Like with about these scientists that are trying to use research and information that they get by interacting with otherworldly species and aliens, basically, and then get caught in like this big swarm hive-minded alien bug colony. Like, it's fine, but I kind of got the twist of what was going to happen. Like, and that's not a bad thing to know what to, you know, expect what's going to happen. It's just the execution was like a little too early, maybe. I don't know. Like, I knew the moment Simon Afriel, who's voiced by Jason Winston George, showed up at the colony to meet Rosario Dawson's character, just kind of knew what was going to happen.
With this story, you really can only go in one direction. And for a lot of this, I was just kind of waiting for the twist to happen. I also think like this kind of has the least satisfying ending. Ends on a point where you're like, wait, that's it? The story could keep going. It just doesn't.
No, it just stops. And that's a shame, because I was enjoying a lot of them up until this point, and I think Swarm is the weakest. But then they pick back up with Mason's Rats, about a Scotland farmer who has a rat problem, who ends up having to deal with it with these big, over-the-top pest control, killing robots, and then finding out that the rats have a civilization and intelligence to actually fight back. Like, one, stylized animation, love the human looks. Two, great performances from Craig Ferguson and Dan Stevens.
Some of my favorite actors.
And then just the absurdity of the technology the rats are using. Like that one point at the end where they're fighting that big skeleton pest control robot. And you see like this rat come in with a tank like vehicle. And it's like, whoa, it's a lot of fun. It's like Redwall, but like modern day instead of fantasy.
I honestly could have watched an entire movie with this premise.
It's probably one of the shorts that could go into a movie. Some of these could go into like a TV series or their own feature film. And I would be pretty happy with that. I mean, granted, some of them do work as shorts, but some of them could be like, yeah, you could expand upon something like Suits or Zima Blue to be feature length if you wanted to. But Zima Blue kind of works as a short on its own.
Yeah.
But I did like the ending to Mason's Rats, where he just befriends the rats, and then he finds out that the rats were making whiskey. Very charming. Probably one of my other favorites. And then we get into more of the hyper-realistic, this feels like a video game kind of thing, with In Vaulted Halls Entombed, which, granted, I like the cast, where we have Joe
Manganiello,
Christian Serratos, Jai Courtney, Deborah Wilson, Fred Tatasciore, Noshir Dalal, Stanton Lee, and Jeff Shine. And I mean, it's fine. I kind of got what was happening. I mean, granted, I think Sony Pictures Imageworks has done some great work here. They also did the
Lucky 13.
And I did like the big Lovecraftian creature that they were encountering, which I'm sure Fred Tatasciore was the one voicing.
Probably.
And it has like a fairly bleak ending, but I just didn't take too much away from it. Was it a shame? Because I liked the cast and the animation was pretty good. I guess I wanted something more after seeing Mason Rats.
Yeah, again, this kind of goes back to what I said earlier. It's not that I would ever call this poorly animated, because on the technical side, this is like stellar work. This kind of feels more like it belongs in Volume 1 compared to the rest of these shorts.
Right, right. And it's like some of the deaths were kind of gory and gruesome. There just wasn't too much time to really let the characters sink in. And maybe that's kind of the point, but still. And then we end on another Alberto Mielgo short with Jibaro, which is pretty much the one that's also been taken up a lot of the talk with, like, everyone, like even my coworkers who aren't into animation like you and I really love this one short. And it's another stylized motion capture CGI humans with a sort of cartoonish look to them combined with motion capture and just some very vibrant visuals and some definitely dark topics if you know what you're looking at.
Yeah.
With the conquistadors and all that stuff.
Kind of like The Witness. This is definitely a trippy experience. Again, similar, but even more so compared to The Witness. There's hardly any dialogue, partially because our main protagonist is actually deaf, which is a great detail because the sound design is very, You pretty much are in his head the whole time.
Right, and just the movements were all really good. Him seeing all his knights get like pulled in by the siren, like pulling into the water and all of them drowning and swinging around, very dance-like movements. It's a feast for the eyes, as they say, with this short. And another one that ends on a very tragic note for our main character. And just all the commentary and just with the gold on top of the woman and such, and how it's like literally part of her skin. And just like, you could pull a lot from this one short mm-hmm. in terms of themes and commentary. Makes for a really fun one to discuss. That is also ruined by the fact that there's a QR code at the end of it.
God.
Nobody likes NFTs, Netflix. Nobody does. The only ones who do are stupid, stubborn crypto bros who are basically spending money between one another for mediocre art. You don't need to shove these in front of like the two shorts that are all about humanity and greed. After all this, with the big crash in the NFT market and that whole stupid thing with Seth Green's like Bored Ape getting stolen and bought back, and then that show he's working on, it's like, do these people just not see themselves as the villains? Or who was in charge of putting the NFT stuff in there? Was it Netflix or was it the two directors? Because those never show up in any of the other shorts.
That's a good question. It is kind of weird how it only shows up at like in the first episode and the last episode and nothing in between.
Exactly. So why did they think they needed to do that? NFTs have like the most rotten reputation right now for good reason. They suck. Even this one art festival that was all about like the indie comic scene got so much flack because they were going to bring on an NFT artist, and then they had to basically get ratioed on Twitter to be told that that was a terrible idea. It was just like, I don't know. It really sours two of the better shorts of Volume 3 with that stupid little QR code at the end.
Although fortunately, the QR code for this one, it's pretty blink and you miss it. The first is a little bit more blatant.
It is, but I'd rather them just not be there at all. They can edit that. They can just take them off. Because nothing good happens with these stupid things. They're, NFTs are killing the bloody environment, and yet they put an NFT on the one that's all about human greed.
Tone deaf.
Very tone deaf. Or the one where all the humans are dead. And I don't know if that was meant to be kind of like, well, screw it, we'll put it in front of the two ones that would make it super ironic. I don't know. At the very least, my five favorites from Volume 3 were Three Robots, Exit Strategies, Bad Traveling, Night of the Mini Dead, Mason's Rats, and Jibaro.
Again, same.
Yeah, it's like, even though the NFT thing is very gross, I still enjoyed the shorts. I just wish the NFT things weren't there. At least that wasn't part of the plot.
Luckily, the QR codes do not affect the quality of these shorts, but it just really sucks that they're involved at all.
Right. And that's just a shame. Like, Love, Death, and Robots has so much potential, but it seems to kind of stumble a little. Not as bad as in Volumes 2 and 3. But Volume 1 definitely set a tone that adult animation is already in a state of, like, it's either shock humor and gross out stuff or intense hyperviolence. It's just a shame that, like, a lot of that is going to overtake some of the better shorts that do not, like, rely on hyperviolence, that focus on the writing, the characters, the themes, and giving you a good story within that short.
I think what I like about season 3 more so than the previous volumes is, no offense to Philip Gelott, but volume 3 is the one season where he was involved the least. So there was much more variety in terms of the types of stories being told. I don't know when slash if we're getting a volume 4. I'm pretty sure it's coming next year. But one thing I hope is they continue to bring on new writers and just new voices in general. That's something I've really liked about this anthology, is that it's not just a platform for, like, you know, the big names. Like, some of the directors that Tim Miller and David Fincher wanted to bring on for their version of heavy metal. Yeah, they wanted James Cameron, Zack Snyder, Kevin Eastman, Gore Verbinski, Del Toro, Mark Osborne. These are pretty big names, but I like how this series kind of gives the lesser known but still highly regarded people a chance to shine.
Yeah, And I just want to see different writers next time and even more different animation styles. Like, glad that we are still getting a lot of variety among the visuals. I just want there to be something a little different than no hyper-realistic shorts for a season. Like, let's just see what you could do with just trying all different visual styles. I mean, I still recommend checking these out. I hope that the acclaim and popularity of these shorts like goes from the shorts to feature films. It's interesting because of how many times we have like influential TV shows, it never seems to translate to films. And you could say that's because films cost a lot of money and they want to get the biggest audience that they can. And doing something like for PG-13 and R does limit that. But I think it's time for animation, at least in the theatrical scene, to start trying out something different than what they're used to. And do give a shot for some more PG-13 and R-rated animated films.
I think the proof of concept for how well adult animation can perform theatrically will be the projects that Genndy Tartakovsky is doing at Sony.
Right. He's got a new HBO Max show coming out. Primal is just great. So it can work. It can happen. There are audiences for these more philosophical and dark and mature like shows and stories. You just need the right producers to say, sure, this will be our next project for the next 3 to 4 years. And it will be R-rated or PG-13 rated. And like, to be fair, having an R rating doesn't mean it's instantly going to be more mature, because, you know, we've seen what happens when some films get an R rating or a PG-13 rating and they come off as extremely juvenile.
There's a difference between adult and mature. Maturity in storytelling does not necessarily mean you have to have sex, you have to have violence, and you have to have cursing. It means you have the freedom to include these, but you have to have substance. And that's what I am hoping we get more of on the big screen.
In terms of recommendations, I'm going to recommend an Amazon animated series called Fairfax. It had a second season drop recently, and I watched through about half of it. I was a fan of Fairfax when season one dropped, and how it was a adult comedy that approached the journey of a bunch of teenagers who want to be cool through the viewpoint in the world of influencers. But it doesn't feel tacky about it. It's, I mean, granted, it's a little corny and eye-rolling when you see some of the stuff and dialogue, but then you kind of think about it and it's like, nah, this is very realistic to what influencer culture looks like to someone on the outside of it all. Because to me, it's all like a bunch of mumbo jumbo at times. And then I see it's like, we're about to drop some new loot. And it's just like, really? Y'all are about to pay a bunch of money for this? It does have like very likable characters, a very diverse cast of actors, and JB Smoove and John Leguizamo play these two pigeons that comment on events, and they're very delightful. Like, there's a very good charm to it that I was very happy to see amongst the adult animation fare that's on like TV, on streaming and such.
How is the like the actual animation? Because I know Titmouse was involved.
It's good. I mean, it definitely has like those moments of like either they weren't given enough time to polish out the looks of everything and just how puppety some of it all looks, but I think it looks better than just a typical like, oh, we're trying to be like Family Guy looking thing. Like at least it's not trying to look like Family Guy or what have you and such. Like, we're past that point where they think looking like Family Guy is going to get them all the love and support, because that's not true anymore. You need to stand out. That's why people like Invincible. This is why people like Vox Machina and such. Or like Undone. Amazon has like a really good roundup of adult animation, and yet barely anyone talks about it. That's unless it's Invincible, or, you know, too many people are caught up with talking about The Boys. with nothing bad about that. It's just take all that support and love that everyone has for the boys and focus it on their other stuff.
Speaking of Undone, we should probably talk about that soon someday, but that's not my recommendation. I kind of have to recommend Young Justice Phantoms now that the season is over. And boy, was this finale something incredible. One of these days, we'll try to talk about this in full because I've just fallen head over heels for the show ever since it came back a few years ago. There's a comic that's coming out next month called Young Justice The Target, like their second comic book spinoff. So if you're a DC fan and haven't been catching up with the show, you should definitely check this out sooner rather than later, especially if you're a big Superman fan, hence the subtitle Phantoms.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I need to catch up on the season. I very much enjoyed the new season so far, and hopefully with everything going on with HBO Max and Discovery and such, it doesn't get canceled, but we'll have to see.
Hashtag Renew Young Justice. That's a wrap for this episode. Next week, we got a big one. Obviously, we're going to talk about Lightyear, but also Mad God is finally being released on Shudder. I'm definitely looking forward to checking out this one.
Agreed. And we're also going to talk about the Netflix film Chicken Hair.
But until then, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at CamsEyeView. I run my own website called CamsEyeView.biz, where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/CamsEyeView. If you like my work and send some support in some way, shape, or form, you can go there.
And you guys can find me on Twitter at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can find me in all the various Facebook groups just at my name. You can check out Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and Twitter at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube and Podchaser and the Banana Meter. Listen to all of our podcasts on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.